time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. This is our show for May 18th, 2019, and I'm Greg Pretty, sitting in for Diane Jenks this week. Diane is recovering from a bad case of laryngitis, but never fear, she and her voice will return next week. Fortunately, she recorded a trio of engaging interviews earlier in the week, and we'll get to those in just a moment. This is our first broadcast at our new morning time slot, so I hope you have a nice breakfast beverage and are ready for a new episode of the show. Our first guest is Mara Abbott. Abbott is the first U.S. cyclist to win the Giro d'Anne, one of the grand tours of women's bicycle racing. She's been our national road race champion, has won the Tour of the Gila multiple times, and decided to retire after the 2016 Olympics, where she placed fourth in the women's road race. Today, Mara is a freelance journalist, and her recent article for Trainwright.com, titled Retired Athletes Open Up About Post-Career Battles, caught our attention. Mara will give us some insight into what it takes to be an elite athlete, how who you are shapes the athlete you are, and how the athlete you are shapes the person you become. Her insights are fascinating. After a break, we head to upstate New York to speak with ride director Karen Empey about the 19th annual Great Big Fanny Ride, spelled F-A-N-Y. Say what you will about the name, but this week-long ride through New York, this year with a brand new course, will offer something for everyone as it winds its way from Plattsburgh up north to the heart of the Hudson Valley, where it ends in Poughkeepsie, home of the Culinary Institute of America. And finally, we welcome Dr. Jonathan Hirsch back to the show for the second in our four-part series on orthopedic sports. This time we're talking knees, from taking good care of them to knowing what to do when you experience knee pain or injury. So off we go to Boulder, Colorado, for a chat with pro cyclist Mara Abbott.
Hi, Mara. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to talk to you.
Yeah, I'd like to know, and I know my listeners are going to want to know, about you, your career, and then we're going to kind of delve into a topic that you wrote for Trainwright, which is, I think, part of the CTS, the Carmichael Training Systems.
Yeah, it's just for the CTS blog.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your racing career and what brought you to cycling. I don't think you started out as a cyclist.
So I started racing bikes in college, actually. I was a swimmer when I was growing up, and I did some races. I wasn't that good of a swimmer, and so by the time I got to college, I was swimming Division III, and that was sort of going to be the end of the road for me. But I started doing some bike races with the cycling club at my college, at Whitman College. And it turned out that I was a far better cyclist than I was a swimmer. And so over the course of my college career, I sort of slowly but surely and with some protest transitioned out of my career as a swimmer and into one as a cyclist. And so when I graduated from college, I actually went into cycling full time right away. And then went on, I raced with a bunch of different teams. My career went on, I was a pro for almost exactly a decade. And I did both stints. I was primarily still lived in America, but did a lot of time over in Europe. I won the Women's Giro twice in 2010 and in 2013. I was the U.S. national champion twice as well, both in 2007 and 2010. And then I finished my career at the Rio Olympics in 2016. And after that, I retired.
Yeah, you know, I was reading something about you looking at the next Olympics, which would have been, I guess it's Tokyo coming up, saying it's just not your kind of course. So you're a climber.
I am, although honestly, since, you know, originally I'd been given the information that the Tokyo course was going to be pancake flat, And it's actually looking like it's going to be a much harder course than we originally thought, which is going to be awesome in terms of a spectator sport. So I don't want to get any rumors out there about it being a flat course, because that's not the way it's looking anymore.
So all you sprinters, do not line up for this course and think that it's going to be flat. I got it.
Don't the fans think that I'm stupid and don't know what I'm talking about?
Well, you didn't make it up. You heard it somewhere, clearly.
Yeah, but it changed.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Mara Abbott. She's in Boulder, Colorado. She's a retired pro cyclist, but she has a lot of cool things to say. And recently you did write an article titled Retired Athletes Open Up About Post-Career Battles. And there's been a lot of things, and I've reported a lot of things recently, certainly the article in the Seattle Times about Rebecca Twigg and the issues she's been facing for years, and finally she's opening up a little bit. There's speculation that a cyclist down in Australia, Cantwell, took his own life, and nobody knows for sure. And I'm wondering what some of these battles that these retired athletes told you about are.
So I did not actually title the article. That was my editor's doing. And so what the premise of the article actually was more looking at people who are coming out of sport and using Rebecca as a jumping off point, but sort of looking at what did sport leave you with? And is that always a good thing, or is it a bad, like, does sport only leave you with gifts, or does it leave you with struggles as well? And so actually the only other retired pro that I talked to was a man named George DiCarlo. And I don't remember his year. I want to say, I'm going to get it wrong if I say it, so I'm not going to say it. But he was a swimmer. He won a gold medal in the Olympics back about 30 years ago. And he's actually...
1984.
Thank you. I'm going to get this wrong. And
nah, you would have been fine.
was a gold medalist, and he retired after that. And I actually got to meet him at a swimming event last summer, which was pretty fun. And so I talked to him a little about his journey, just because he's had a longer span of time to be with it. And I think that a lot of, you know, one of the things that a lot of people that I've talked to, just even friends who've gone through the transition out of sport, is that it just takes time, and that people don't transition out of sport terribly easily. And I don't know, it's possible that there are some people who are better at it than I have been, or that some of my friends have been. But really just that it's not an easy transition to come out of a life that is that structured, and that's that black, that has that much purpose and much focus, and to try and transition into a more traditional career, a more traditional lifestyle.
That's interesting. You use the word structured, and it never occurred to me how structured an athlete life is, and then but until you think about it, and then it's like, yes, every single minute is pretty much planned out if you're going to be an elite athlete. Two of the statements that were made in that article is who you are shapes the athlete you are, and the athlete you are shapes the person you become. And I'm not sure that I quite understand it all. So how does who you are shape the athlete you are? What is it that you think shaped you as an athlete?
I was quoting someone else, but I think that for me, what that means is, you know, I mean, if you watch any competitor, everyone has different strengths and different weaknesses, both mentally and physically. And you see athletes who really excel when there's bad weather, and you see athletes who are best at the end of a long race, and you see athletes, you know, you'd see this actually in swimming, where you see the athletes before the race, and there are some of people who need to be around all of their friends and getting pumped up, and they see other people who really need to be quiet and need to center themselves. You know, I think that that was in relation to sort of looking at someone where you're maybe going to look at someone and think, man, they're a hyper-competitive person, and they're not someone I want to be my best friend, but that's exactly what makes them an extraordinary athlete. Whereas someone who's really demure and really polite and really thinks of others all the time maybe isn't going to be the best athlete, or maybe they are because they're going to build better relationships. And so it's sort of like any career, the characteristics that you bring as an individual, there's no strict analysis of what makes a good athlete. And so who you are is going to shape your athletic career as much as your physical gifts.
And then you say, or whoever decided to call this out, athlete you are shapes the person you become. How does your athletic career dovetail into what comes next?
So I think that that was part of a segment of the article where I moderated a panel at CU and University of Colorado Boulder. And one of the athletes on that panel talked about, it wasn't that he said, you know, it's not that being an athlete shapes you or it changes you or it turns you into a different person. And his take was more that the challenges that you face as an athlete reveal who you already were underneath. And so the habits and the challenges and the things that you pick up as an athlete, it's not that it changes you. It's not that it shapes you, but it reveals stuff about you that might have gone unnoticed or might not have become part of your day-to-day if you hadn't put yourself in that position.
Interesting. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Mara Abbott. She's in Boulder, Colorado, talking about athletes actually after they retire, these elite pro athletes, of which she is one. So there's another whole side to becoming an elite athlete, and I don't know if it's prevalent or not. Forgetting the issue of doping and drugs, let's assuming that that doesn't really impact this part of it. We've got Rebecca Twigg, who's clearly been suffering for a long time, although she was just the golden girl in our sport for a long time. We've got the young,
Kelly Catlin, yeah.
Yeah, Kelly Catlin, who was another clearly driven young woman, and she took her own life. What do you think has changed in our, maybe it's society, or maybe it is sport, that makes these athletes seem so driven to actually not be able to cope outside of either being on the bike, being in the pool, whatever it is?
Well, so I guess so the first thing I would say is that if we're looking at both Kelly and looking at Rebecca, I would say nothing. I mean, it isn't a change because those athletes were separated by decades.
That's true.
I don't know that there's a change that has occurred. And my own experience is with, you know, the last 10 or 15 years. So I can't really speak to before then. But I also think that it's not necessarily, you know, you say, oh, well, what makes it hard for these athletes to exist outside of sport? And I think that what a lot of people don't consider is sort of the chicken or the egg paradox, where you're saying, well, is it possible that the people who excel at athletes have these characteristics of being driven, of loving having that focus, of having that self-focus, sort of not necessarily introverted, but that willingness to work on themselves and to protect themselves, and that they thrive off having that challenge, and that whether or not that person found sport, that those are not characteristics that make for a particularly easy life wherever you are. And the fact is that in sport, those characteristics can actually play to your favor and they make you a great athlete. And so it makes sport a very safe place for people who, and I am not a psychologist at all, as a disclaimer, this is just sort of my observation, but it makes sport a very safe and productive place for people who would have struggled out in the quote-unquote real world regardless. And so it's not necessarily that their sports career made it harder for them. It's that sport actually was the perfect place for them. It's just that that's not a career that lasts forever.
It's a really interesting observation. It makes perfect sense when you say it that way, that sport is what maybe kept them on, you know, on a path to being okay. And when it was taken away, and in the case of Rebecca, she walked away from cycling and didn't fit in anywhere. At least she didn't think she fit in anywhere else, as far as Kelly will never know. So do you think that there are outside pressures that we don't see that may or may not be affecting athletes differently from the general population? For example, coaches or parents who tend to, you know, sort of project their own wishes on their kids, like, oh, I wish I had been the Olympic athlete, or I wish I had been the pro golfer.
I mean, it's possible. I think that, you know, when you're looking at cyclists, they are going to be older than your typical athlete. And so you're going to be looking at cyclists who are adults. And so I think that the parents' pressure, while it can shape thought patterns as a child, it's going to be less the dominant factor than it might be in some sports where people peak younger. But I also think that, you know, and I don't know, because I have always had really amazing coaches, and I've had really amazing parents who, you know, supported me in everything that I did, but never pressured me to do more. And so I actually can't speak to people who have had those challenges because that hasn't been my experience. But part of me, my instinct is to sort of take the same tack as I did with the previous question, which is to say that I think that those things can be triggers. And so having a critical coach or having a director who's hard on you, those things can trigger negative thought patterns in people, and that definitely can get out of control. But again, those don't always shape who you are. And I think that one of the things that I was fortunate enough to pick up from my coach primarily is sort of all of the information that I'm getting in as an athlete, I'm picking and I'm choosing what it is that I'm going to assimilate and what it is that I'm going to let be a part of my self-concept. And so if I'm getting negative feedback, it's my choice to listen to that. And I think that that's part of what allows some athletes to have longevity, because you look at a lot of athletes who are young and they end up having these short careers, or they burn out early, and it's due to pressures as a child from parents and from coaches. And then as an adult, you sort of have more of a privilege to pick who you're listening to. And I think that when you're self-driven and you're aware of what's true, and when you have people who can keep you on that line, you're more able to block out that noise. And that's what makes for a long career.
Do you think that injury has a lot or anything to do? There was some speculation with Kelly specifically that the crash that she had a pretty severe concussion. Do you think that that often or maybe impacts some negative results with these athletes?
So in terms of concussions, I think that, you know, that's something that we've seen a lot with football, and I think we're just starting to look into that with cycling. And, you know, I've talked to friends who are also recently retired cyclists, and we've sort of said, you know, I mean, I retired less than 3 years ago. And when I was racing, I knew that getting a concussion was not a good thing, but I didn't have that same understanding of what the long-term risks of a concussion are. And it's sort of the same. It's a thing where I look at it now and I'm like, man, I'm lucky that I was able to make it out in one piece, in, so to speak. But I think that that's something we're really just beginning to understand. And I think that the link between concussions and depression is something that I hope that people are able to study. Not that it's an easy thing to study, but I hope that that's something we can get to have more understanding about, because it's a really big deal.
Right. It is. It seems to be a big deal. I mean, certainly they picked it up in the NFL. It took them forever. But now it seems to be accelerating a little bit with other sports, which is a good thing. So what are you working on now? Are you working on anything along these same lines, or are you just starting to do something completely different? What are you doing?
So I've been working on journalism. I actually have just recently got a job that's going to start at the beginning of June. I'm going to move up to Wyoming and be reporting on the energy industry up there with for a local paper as part of a fellowship program called Report for America. So I'm going to be up and doing that. I've been doing the CTS blog on sort of a bi-weekly basis for the last week and a half, and that's just sort of all different sorts of topics. I've been working at a local farm, farmer's market in Boulder, but that's nothing new. I was doing that with my career as well. So sort of piecing things together and figuring it out.
Well, I like the idea that you're working on energy. That's cool. Wyoming's cool. You know, you have a really good legislator up there by the name of Charles Pelkey. I don't know if you know him.
I'm working on learning all the politics up there now. That's my current project.
Well, Charles actually used to report on the Tour de France. He and Patrick O'Grady used to do a ongoing daily blog, so you could log on and chat with them all day as they talked about the tour. And so he,
oh, how interesting.
Yeah, he's a legislator up there, but he's also a really hardcore cyclist. Well, Mara, thank you so much for talking with me. I think your insights are really interesting, and I think they're spot on, and I appreciate you being thoughtful about the way athletes sort of can perform or not. So thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you for thinking of me.
All right. You take care and enjoy Wyoming.
I will. Thanks so much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mara Abbott joined us from her home in Boulder, Colorado. Her article about elite athletes and some of the issues they face after retiring is available at trainwright.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll head to upstate New York to speak with Karen Empey about the Great Big Fanny Ride. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Greg Priddy, sitting in for Diane this week, who has an acute case of laryngitis. If you've never been to upstate New York, way upstate, you may be missing some of the most beautiful part of the country. The Adirondack Park is 6 million acres of preserved land, and the roads and towns that dot them are beautiful and welcoming. This year, the 19th annual Great Big Fanny Ride, that's spelled F-A-N-Y, takes place from July 21st to the 26th. And here is ride director Karen Empey to tell us all about it.
Hi, Karen. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Oh, thank you, Diane. Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's going to be fun because we are talking about bike tours. We're trying to get a bunch of really good tours mentioned to our listeners. And New York has some really good ones. So we spoke with Dick Porterfield, who you know about the Finger Lakes, the Great Finger Lakes Bike Tour. And he told me about your tour. And I had no idea, even though it's been long standing, it's the Fanny Ride, which I just love the name of it. So tell us about the Fanny Ride. What is it? It'll be the 19th year, and we'll talk about the route and some other things.
Sure. With the Great Big Fanny Ride, and that actually stands for 500 across New York. So it's only one in it, one N in it, F-A-N-Y-R-I-D-E, the Great Big Fanny Ride. It's a linear tour. We move every day. Each new day, each new sunrise brings us something new to look at. We don't have any out and backs. We don't have any rest days. We're an old school linear tour.
I like that because so many are out and back these days.
Yeah.
So the route, though, this year is different from previous years. I know you're starting way up north in Plattsburgh. Tell us a little bit about Plattsburgh. I happen to know a little more about it just because we have a relative who lives up.
Oh, sure. Yes, this year is very different. Traditionally, we've gone west to east from Niagara Falls to Saratoga, but we decided to shake things up for our 19th year. So we're starting in Plattsburgh. And Plattsburgh is way up just above the Adirondack Park. It's 25 miles from Canada. You had really good pitching arm, you could throw a stone to it. But the other cool thing about Plattsburgh is it's nested right up against the shores of Lake Champlain. And across Lake Champlain, you can see the Green Mountains of Vermont. On top of that, it's got three microbreweries, two bike stores. It's got one of the largest freshwater beaches in the country. And it's a fantastic place to start a bicycle adventure.
Well, you're going to a place that I really like. I love the Hudson Valley, and you're going to end up in Poughkeepsie, which is also the home of Vassar. And I think it's also the home of the Culinary Institute of America, as I remember.
That's true. The Culinary Institute is just slightly north of where we're going to be ending. But people come early before the tour or if they have an extra day after the tour, that would definitely be a great place to stop and schedule a lunch and make sure they include that in their visit to the Poughkeepsie area.
Tell us a little bit about the route itself, some of the terrain and some of the interim stops between Plattsburgh and Poughkeepsie.
Oh, my word. This year's tour is absolutely fantastic. One of the things also that we're doing new this year is traditionally we've averaged about 70 miles a day. But for this year's tour, I've made sure that we have a 50-mile option every day in addition to our traditional 70-mile. So we're going to start on Sunday up in Plattsburgh. And we're going to follow in between like the Adirondack Mountains and the Lake Champlain shore. And we're going to look across the lake. We pursue the view. We go where it's pretty. So we're going to cross into Vermont on a little ferry. And then that's going to give us the glorious views looking back at the Adirondack Mountains. This is the first year that Fannie's ventured outside of New York State's borders. And the reason is because the views from Vermont of New York's Adirondacks are spectacular. On Tuesday, we're going to skip back and forth across the border between New York and Vermont. And it's a border in a valley called Slate Valley. And this is postcard perfect. It's red barns. It's white churches. It's a valley. Tuesday's route is absolutely spectacular. Wednesday, we're going to start from a little town called Cambridge. And Cambridge is in the Cambridge Valley. And that Cambridge is actually the hometown of the Tour of the Baton Kill, which is one of the largest road races in New York, in North America. So it's an absolutely fantastic area for bicycling. Thursday, we're going to be, and it's also the area where Grandma Moses used to paint, one of the great primitive artists, Grandma Moses. So people might be familiar with the scenery from this area from some of her things. Keeping the art theme on Thursday, we're going to go through Artsy Hudson. It's the town of Hudson, just has a really great art vibe. Then we're going to go past the home of the studio with Thomas Cole, who is one of the famous Hudson River painters. And there's an option to go to Opus 40, which is a great stone open field art exhibit. Friday is going to be our last day already. We're going to go past two old Dutch towns, stone houses built in the 1700s, history just galore, finishing going over the walkway over the Hudson to bring us into our finish in Poughkeepsie. It is a glorious route, and people have the opportunity to do 50 miles a day or 70.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Karen Empey. She is the ride director for the Great Fannie Tour, the 500 miles across New York. How are you doing 50 and or 70 and getting people into the overnights?
Well, basically, if you think that, think of our route as like the capital letter P. And so the spine of the capital letter P is basically the 50-mile route. Then the bulge will give you the optional. So that's how they're getting that. Everybody's traveling to the same towns. Everybody's seeing mostly the same route. But then the 70-mile options include a little bit extra.
Are we talking about all on-road cycling? There aren't any, like, paths or bike trails or towpaths?
I would say 95%, 94% of the route.
Don't get too precise here now.
Right. 93.75% is all road miles. Our roads are not closed, but I work to find the most scenic, the quietest roads that we can possibly string together and put together a ride of this magnitude. There are a couple stretches where we're on bike trails, and there are a couple stretches where we might be for a mile or so on a dirt road, but they're really negligible in terms of the overall route.
How are you working accommodations?
Well, at this point, we have our hotel options are full, but when you sign up, you have included in your registration fee, outdoor camping, an opportunity for outdoor camping, or all of our overnight towns have an indoor option. So that's included for free with registration. We also have a fabulous company called Comfy Campers, and they are a tent service. And oh my word, they make you feel special and pampered. When you pull into camp each night, there's a tent set up just for you. You always have the same assigned tent each night, always number 7 or whatever for yourself. There's the inflatable, the mattress is already fully inflated, nice and comfortable. There's chairs out set out in front of you. So the Comfy Campers are our touch of class on the tour.
Nice. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And what about food and food options? Are you catering? Are people stopping?
what we've done for all of our history is that we believe that it's really polite and the right thing to do to support the people who are trying to make a business in the small towns that we go through.
Nice.
As part of their charm is that they're so small and oftentimes there's not the chain restaurants or whatever. So we make a point of encouraging people to support our neighbors in upstate New York, basically. So we do not have a caterer that follows with us. However, on the cue sheets, we make sure that we identify where a restaurant is and whether or not it's a coffee and bagel place, whether it's a full menu, whether it opens at 5 in the morning, or whether you have to wait until 8 o'clock before they're open. So you know exactly what's in front of you and what you can find to eat. And, this way it helps you customize the tour that you want also, because you're picking, oh, I need to find the vegan option, or, you know, I want to sleep in. I don't want to have to rush and get there at 5:30. I'm going to wait for that place at 8. So that's how we do breakfast and lunches. And then dinners, we do have an option for dinner. We'll work with a local caterer in each town. The best local caterer in the town will bring a dinner to camp. And these are for the people who say, you know what, I'm done. I just biked 70 miles. Somebody bring me my dinner.
Right.
Or other people are like, hey, hold on. I have never been in Fairhaven, Vermont before. I want to explore this area on my own. So that's why we didn't bundle it into the registration fee. We're trying to let people kind of customize the tour and make it what they want. We give them all the information so that they can fine-tune the tour, you know, for their needs.
Sure. One thing we didn't talk about, and I know the Adirondacks fairly well in that part of New York, what about the terrain in terms, you did say about climbing a mountain, what kind of climbing can people, I don't know which mountain we're talking about here, but I know there are like 46 peaks in the Adirondacks.
You know, as soon as I said mountain, I was like, oops, I probably shouldn't have said mountain. In the past, we've gone like through the Finger Lakes areas, and the Finger Lakes region, especially if you're going west to east, those are short, steep inclines. And this year, we're really trying to feature coming down through the Lake Champlain Valley, then the Slate Valley, then the Cambridge Valley, and the Hudson Valley. Now, I'm not saying this year is flat. Basically, our 50-mile routes average anywhere between 2,100 and 2,500 feet of climb each day. So, you know, that's enough to keep it interesting. A flat route, you pedal every single mile. Whereas you get a little bit of climb, you get a little bit of reward back. I always try to make sure that even though we are climbing, I've never wasted a hill. People say I go out of my way to find hills. That's really just a rumor. You know,
maybe
we pursue the view. And a lot of times the view is from the top of the hill.
Sure.
So if we go up there, I want to make sure that you get a fabulous descent downhill. It's going to put a smile on your face, or you're going to find a view where you knew God stood at the top of it and God said, I did good.
Right, exactly.
I did good.
Your
yeah.
reward for that climb. So
exactly.
It is a point-to-point, Plattsburgh to mm-hmm. Poughkeepsie. How are you mm-hmm. getting people? Are people driving to Poughkeepsie or coming to Poughkeepsie and you're busing them and their bikes? How does that work?
Exactly. We have actually a bus on either end. So if you want to drive to Poughkeepsie, which is technically where we're ending, and that's the majority of what people do. We've got two buses doing that. People will come to Poughkeepsie. We'll load bikes on our truck. We'll load people on the buses. Everybody drives up to Plattsburgh, and we start heading south. People who are coming from Canada, from Maine, from New Hampshire, it's easier for them to stay at the northern end, park their cars at Plattsburgh, where we're starting. They bicycle to the end, and then we have an optional return shuttle bus from the back end also.
So given that, it sounds like there's a cap on the number of riders you're going to have.
Right. We'll cap it at 200. We are slightly over half full at this point.
Mm.
We have, as I said, sold out of the hotels, but we have plenty of room for people who want to camp. We've got the comfy campers for those who want to splurge a little bit more. And we also have a four-day and a two-day option. So if people say, hey, you know, it sounds really good, but maybe for my first venture out, I might not want to do 6 days in a row. We've got a 4 day and a half day option too.
Nice. So mm-hmm. I guess one of the things we haven't said is when is it?
You're right. We haven't said that.
I saved that for the end.
Perfect. It is the last full week in July. So on Saturday, July 20th, we gather together up in Plattsburgh. And on Sunday, July 21st, we start bicycling, pedaling our way down to Poughkeepsie, will be there on July 26th. So the short answer is July 21 through 26th of this year.
And how can people find out more? Where is the website?
The website is fannyride.com. So that's FANYRIDE.com.
Well, it sounds like a fabulous, well-organized event. And I think that anybody who has not had any time in that part of the country that, you know, people think of upstate New York as anything north of New York City. But if you don't know the Adirondack Park area, it is stunning. It's 6 million plus acres of wildness, and it's beautiful. Well, Karen, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Diane.
We've been talking with Karen Empey. She is the ride director. I imagine that on the site you can contact her if you have any questions. It's FANYRIDE.com. Good luck with this year's event, and I'll be watching.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate it.
All right. You have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Karen Empey is the ride director for the Great Big Fanny Ride. More information, including registration, is available at Great Big Fanny Ride, that's Fanny with one N, .com. Let's take another short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with our orthopedic sports specialist, Dr. Jonathan Hirsch, about knees. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back once again on The Outspoken Cyclist. My name's Greg, and I'm filling in for Diane, who will return along with her voice next week. Dr. Jonathan Hirsch is an orthopedic sports specialist, and in this, our second of a four-part series, Diane and Dr. Hirsch discuss some of the knee issues that plague many of us when we ride and even off the bike.
Hello, Dr. Hirsch. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist, part two of our four-part series on sports injuries. We're going to talk about knees today. How are you?
I'm great, Diane. How are you?
I got a little bit of a cold, but at least it's warming up here, so I'm okay. I'm okay.
Good to hear. Yeah. Maybe you'll get on the bike soon.
Well, yeah, that would be really, really nice. We're supposed to actually get to 80 this weekend, which is, that's my weather. I love it.
Perfect.
So before we get into specific issues that might occur with knees, especially for cyclists, I have a question because my students also ask me this, my yoga students. Are women more prone to knee problems than men?
Well, I think that specifically anterior knee pain, I'd say yes. And that's what a lot of cyclists get. So we could talk about what are the common causes of pain in the front of your knee. But I definitely think women are more susceptible to that specifically than men.
Do you have a reason for it? Or can you speculate?
I mean, there's theories. Some of it's the shape of the pelvis versus the leg. So females in general have wider pelvises than men, which makes the angle of the muscles, the quadriceps around the knee different, the angle. They have different strength, hamstring versus quadriceps. So like, for instance, in basketball, non-cycling, women are 6 to 9 times more likely to tear their ACL. Because of that shape and muscle imbalance difference. And I think anterior knee pain is similar. It's a muscle imbalance issue that women get more than men, and also the shape of the pelvis versus the lower extremities.
Okay. So to just take that a little bit farther, are there things women can do to strengthen their knees or to strengthen the supporting, you know, muscles, tendons, ligaments around the knees that would help?
Yeah, and I think they have to look beyond the knees. You got to start from the top down. You need to strengthen your hips especially. And it's been shown that cyclists with knee pain, especially females, they tend to, their knees sort of go in, and that's due to weakness of the outside muscles of their hip. So as the knees go in towards the midline, you're putting more strain on the knee. And so strengthening not just the knees, but the hips and below the knees to the ankle. So it's really the whole thing. So you can just strengthen your knees and do like leg press and things like that, or knee extensions. You're missing part of the problem.
Because it's all connected.
Oh, yes, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what you see as an orthopedic specialist, what we might call normal issues with the knees. And I call them normal because they seem to occur a lot in cyclists. What kinds of things do you see over and over and over again?
Well, you're looking at, it's mostly overuse for most cyclists. If you think about the average cadence, let's say it's 70, 80, you know, you're looking at thousands in a ride, thousands and thousands of revolutions in a typical weekend ride. And if you do that multiple times per week, you're really overloading the tissue. So most of what we see in the knees and in the cycling world is overuse. We see that in other sports, but we also see a lot of injuries, collision injuries and rotational injuries in other sports. But assuming you don't fall off the bike, you know, most knee injuries, again, it's overuse, repetitive use of the cyclist on a bicycle that's giving you knee issues.
So it's not necessarily fit, or is fit and cleat position part of that?
Oh, yes. Of course, you know, if you had perfect fit, you're still at risk for overuse phenomenon. But if you throw in an issue where the cleats aren't in the right position, the seats too far forward, not high enough. So there's multiple positions, right? Up, down, forward, back, and
right.
then your clips. So all of that, you know, it just takes one of those things to be messed up to give you knee pain. So you definitely need to look at that with someone who knows what they're doing, because it's really hard, I think, for most of us to figure that out on our own, unless you took a class or something. So I think bike fitting is very, very important. And even when you buy a new pair of shoes, you got to start all over a little bit with the cleat positioning and things like that.
Right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He is an orthopedic sports specialist. This is the second of a four-part series. This time we're talking about knees. So I wanted to ask you about different times that people sort of experience problems. When someone experiences a knee issue after riding, as opposed to while he or she is riding, what do you usually find out?
You know, I think a lot of the tendinitis issues and even a little bit of arthritis tends to go away when you're all heated up and adrenaline's pumping and you're riding, unless it's really severe. And I find that some of the usual stuff hurts, like you said, more afterwards. During the riding, I'm usually thinking it's something torn inside the knee, like a meniscus tear, something mechanical, something when you're, you know, riding, something's inside the knee is not quite right, whether it's catching, causing the knee to lock or swell. So that's just a general, I mean, it's not a perfect rule, but I do think that derangement of the knee, a true tear of the meniscus or the cartilage, is going to hurt more during. But things like patella tendonitis, anterior knee pain just from patellofemoral issues, seems to sort of linger when you get off the bike. It may actually go away once you start pumping away.
You brought up the term meniscus, and then there's the ACL. We often hear these terms. Can you just briefly tell us what they mean? Where are these different pieces, parts inside the knee?
So there's a medial and a lateral meniscus. There's two. It's a cartilage, rubbery-like disc. It's got a little bit of mobility. It's basically a cushion between the bones, which are lined with cartilage. So it's a different type of cartilage. It's not really connected to the bones. It's like a shock absorber. And it usually can tear with a twisting movement, even just clipping in and out. I've seen people tear their meniscus. And then as we get older, people get meniscus tears for no reason whatsoever. It just becomes more of a degenerative condition, and that can act up during cycling. The ACL, or anterior cruciate ligament, is a central important ligament of the knee that tears usually with a rapid change in direction. Pretty rare to tear on a bicycle, but if you were riding a bicycle with an ACL tear, it's usually actually quite tolerable, but it makes the knee unstable for pivoting activity. if you tear your ACL.
Yeah, one of my yoga students just tore his in half skiing. So he ended up twisting like that and ending up, his upper body was in one direction and his legs were not where they belonged. And he just had surgery. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So is surgery always or usually necessary to repair both an ACL and a torn meniscus, or either or, I should say?
Well, the ACL, if it's torn just by itself, is often reconstructed in, you know, younger patients who want to play pivoting sports. But there's really no age cutoff. You know, anyone who's going to be relatively active, whether it's running, soccer, tennis, basketball, change in direction type activities, we usually recommend reconstruction. But I wouldn't say everyone. If someone is in their 50s and they only cycle for sport, they may be fine. They may have a stable knee that does not require ACL surgery. So it's pretty individualized, especially as we get a little bit older. And the meniscus, the same. There are certainly people who have meniscus tears that have basically no symptoms, but some people have swelling or the knee locks or catches. So it's very individual. I think you can't generalize with these things. They are very common reasons for surgery, but there are alternatives for many people.
Well, as we're getting older, except for us, of course, you and I are not getting older.
No,
of course not. How can we keep our knees healthy to avoid both injury and the dreaded knee replacement, which I do want to talk about?
Well, I think, you know, cycling is the perfect answer to that. I mean, something that's a low impact, closed chain exercise where your foot is planted like cycling is an amazing way to keep your knees strong because it's working everything at once, hips, knees, ankles, feet. And we know that patients who have a minor knee problem, let's say like arthritis, they do much better when they're exercising regularly and keeping their knees strong, you know, and then supplementing, let's say, cycling or swimming with the gym, you know, doing specific lower extremity weights.
So how has knee replacement improved over the past 15 or 20 years? I know it has.
Well, in some ways, it hasn't changed much. What has changed is, in general, trying to be more specific sizing for patients. So using custom implants and then using computer guided systems and now even robotic systems to not only put them in more accurately, but again, make sure they're the right size for the patient. So a one size fits all phenomenon is less now. So the companies are coming up with more size options and a lot of people are now putting them in robotic assisted using CAT scans preoperatively to put them in the mechanical way that's going to make them last longer. So I think that's the goal now is, you know, pain relief, the statistics are probably the same, but longevity is improving because of the implants being better size and put in more accurately.
How has stem cell helped or not with knees?
He's still out on stem cells. I mean, I think that unfortunately there's not a lot of good literature to say yes or no on stem cells to inject it into a knee and have something exciting happen. I think that stem cells in the laboratory right now have an amazing promise of growing tissue and enhancing growth of tissue. But I think just to put it into a joint right now, I think there are things happening that we still don't understand. Definitely there are people who feel better, but I think the word cure should not be in the vocabulary with stem cells at this point. I think it's more a symptom reliever than anything else, a very expensive symptom reliever. And so I think that, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic about it, 10, 15 years of what it's going to do for us in orthopedics. But I think it's still early to say, you know, where it's going and where, when we should actually use it.
We've been speaking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. This is our second of a four-part series talking about orthopedic issues that we might have. What do you want to talk about next time? We've done clavicle. Now we've done knees. What's left? Well, I mean, there's a whole lot left, but pick something. Let's pick something.
You know, hip impingement is an exciting new thing that we're doing hip arthroscopy for.
Okay.
It's sort of a diagnosis that really, when you make it early and treat it early, we really consider it hip preserving. In other words, doesn't necessarily lead to arthritis. So, and it happens in cyclists because of the obvious constant revolutions. And in the position we're in a cycling position, especially on the road, puts us at risk for hip impingement. So I think that hip injuries and then around the hip, other things like hamstrings we could talk about as well.
All right. Well, we will be catching up with you again. Thanks so much for talking with me again this week. And I hope you're out there training.
Oh, I'll be out there.
It's
90 plus down here. So.
Yeah, I know. I'm actually very envious. I like that hot weather. Enjoy yourself. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Hirsch.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our thanks to Dr. Jonathan Hirsch for taking the time to talk with us about knees. He'll be back on another episode of the show soon for the third in our series. If you would like to know more about Dr. Hirsch's work, check out jonathanhirschmd.com. That's HERSCHMD.com. Our thanks also to Mara Abbott and Karen Empey for joining us this week. Diane will be back next week with her own voice, and I hope you'll join her then when she interviews Steve Rex from Rex Cycles. In the meantime, remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page, send a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Thanks for listening, have a great week, and stay safe out there.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.